Lately, he was 3 years old when his father went to prison for being bad at his job. Henry uncharacteristically decided not to imprison his brother's heir. That may sound like a fair way to treat a blameless infant, but Henry wasn't fair any more than life is. He was just predictable. This was a lapse in his own policy. Few would have predicted that he'd have left a male child with a better claim to be King of England and Duke of Normandy than any man living, toddling around the continent making friends. But he did. I wish I could say that Henry was rewarded for this unwonted kindness. But no, he bitterly regretted it.
Messing about in boats. Broadly speaking, you can divide Henry's reign into two halves. The first half in which most things went right for him, and the second half in which most things went right for him. But it is divided into these halves by an absolute catastrophe. In 1120, his only legitimate son and heir was killed in a shipwreck. This was, above all, very, very sad. The prince, whose name was William and was known as William Adelin, a corruption of Atheling, was 17 years old and had recently been endorsed as the next Duke of Normandy by King Louis VI of France. Strictly speaking, this was necessary, notwithstanding the hereditary nature of the duchy and Henry's complete military control over it, because the kings of France were the duke's overlords. Still, it wasn't an act of generosity on Louis's part, but the consequence of his having just lost a small war to Henry. The whole English court was travelling triumphantly back from Barfleur, the preferred port on the Normandy coast, for making swift crossings to England. But the cool kids, led by Adelin, decided to travel in a snazzy new fast vessel called the White Ship. The ghostly connotations of the name are entirely appropriate, because they all died. An entire young generation of Anglo-Norman aristocracy was lost. The sole survivor when the ship sank was a butcher from Rouen. The shipwreck had a greater impact on the English ruling class than the Somme, and achieved even less. Instinctively, one feels one should separate Henry's personal tragedy, and the hundreds of other personal tragedies for other leading families of the realm, and for the more ordinary families of the sailors and servants on board, from its colossal geopolitical impact. Then again, I'm not sure. For Henry, such a capable and successful king, so conscious of his dynasty and legacy, all the more because the justification for his own kingship was so dodgy, the personal loss and the dynastic disaster were inextricable. His grief at the loss of a child will have been supercharged by his feeling that his legacy was in ruins, and the succession crisis made more nightmarish by the enormous personal pain that had caused it. The death of children or teenagers was so much more common back then that on some level it's impossible to believe that the pain felt as unbearable as it does in societies where such tragedies are much rarer. Everyone lost children, so everyone had lots of children, and they coped. Henry, while he had only 2 legitimate children, had over 20 illegitimate ones whom he freely acknowledged and lavished with favour. William Adelin was obviously Henry's favourite son, but he also personified his father's strategy for the future. A prince, named after the conqueror, but given the old Anglo-Saxon heir's sobriquet to signify his descent through his mother, Queen Matilda of Scotland, from the House of Wessex. He was to unite Normandy and England in one royal house under one rightful king, by both primogeniture and porphyrogeniture. He gave all of Henry's prudent brutality, his administrative reforms, his building of an aristocracy he could trust and who trusted him, in a word, his struggle, a reason and point. The prince's death was more than the tragic death of a son, it was also Henry's death. It represented the whole horror and inevitability of death as a concept, its inescapability for kings as well as for peasants, and the lurking futility of all human endeavours. And it was such a stupid cock-up. Everyone on the White Ship was pissed. Adelin, young, hot-headed and the star of the court, had inaugurated a party boat, bringing on board large quantities of wine and encouraging passengers and crew alike to indulge. They spent the whole evening drinking in the harbour while the other ships, including the king's, set sail. Then they decided it would be a laugh to beat them all home. They raced out of the harbour, straight into a rock, and slipped screaming into the freezing sea. Dead from youthful foolishness. It's the pointless, heartbreaking fate of millions of beloved teenagers throughout the ages, and though Henry would never know it, it doomed his peaceful, ordered kingdom, his life's work, to chaos. Smile though your heart is aching. Henry reputedly didn't. They said that he never smiled again after he heard the news of the white ship. I don't know how they kept such a close eye on him. They must have worked in shifts. Another thing they said was that he died of a surfeit of lampreys. A lamprey is a weird, jawless, eel-like fish, which was considered a delicacy. You never see it on a menu anymore, even at those places that make it their mission to concoct dishes out of nostril and ball and bladder. So perhaps, in any society that has access to chips, asserting the lamprey to be delicious is no longer credible. Whatever its objective tastiness, it was a dish quite susceptible to accidental food poisoning, so it may have been the quality rather than the quantity of the lampreys that did for Henry. That was 15 unsmiling years later. In the meantime, he worked hard to deal with the catastrophe. He must have been kicking himself at his failure to father more than one legitimate son, and his wife had died in 1118, 2 years before the shipwreck. He got married again, in 1121, to a very attractive young woman called Adeliza of Louvain, whom he spent the rest of his life failing to impregnate. She subsequently had children with a second husband, and Henry had had kids with loads of different women, so it's odd they remained childless. Somehow, the urgent necessity of an heir militated against the likelihood of begetting one. The whole, OK, quick, let's get a son fathered ASAP, and then I can buckle down to the arduous task of living until he's old enough to be king, vibe, didn't maximise fertility. Plus, a smile might have helped. Henry also had to deal with William Cleto, who had grown up into an impressive and capable young man and increasingly looked like the undeniable heir to all of Henry's dominions, if you don't count Robert Curthose, who was still kicking his heels in Cardiff, dreaming of Deliveroo. The Norman barons, more truculent than the English ones, were keen to make Cleto the official heir. This struck Henry's enemy, the King of France, as a delightful idea, now that Adeline was dead, and in 1127 he made Cleto Count of Flanders. Henry seemed to feel nothing but enmity for his nephew, and was determined that his direct descendants would inherit the kingdom, and in the end he got his way. King Charles III is his 27 greats grandson, and not a direct descendant of Cleto. To screw things up for Cleto, Henry supported a rival claimant to the County of Flanders called Thierry. Cleto defeated Thierry in battle in June 1028, but then, out of the blue, died as a result of wounds incurred in a different battle the following month. The premature death luck had started to go Henry's way again. The question of what was going to happen when Henry himself died remained. Unlike his elder brother William, Henry was obsessed by this question. He had one legitimate heir remaining, his daughter Matilda. I should warn you that, as a name, Matilda is very much the Elfyfu of the 12th century. Henry's mother, first wife and daughter were all called Matilda. Henry's daughter Matilda is going to spend much of her life fighting to be Queen of England, but I'm not risking any spoilers when I say that one person or another called Matilda was Queen of England most of the time from 1066 until the middle of the following century. So the best way of distinguishing Henry's daughter Matilda from the others is to call her the Empress Matilda, and that's what she liked to be called. It wasn't just a mad whim. She was married to the Holy Roman Emperor Henry V until he died in 1125. The couple were childless, and Matilda then headed back to her father, whom she hadn't seen since she was packed off to Germany at the age of 8 as the Emperor's intended bride. Obviously, she didn't marry him when she was 8. That would be barbaric. They waited until she was 12. Not long after Matilda's return, Henry took, for the time, a rather eccentric decision. He decided to make her heir to England and Normandy. For a woman to take on this role was unprecedented for the House of Normandy. The examples of women ruling anywhere at all were few and far between, and usually it had occurred when they were acting on behalf of a husband. There was a widespread feeling among all the powerful men of the time, not necessarily that women couldn't rule, but that they wouldn't be accepted as rulers. But Henry, more out of an obsession with his own bloodline than any glimmer of proto-feminism, decided to name his daughter as his successor. This was in preference to several illegitimate sons, notably Robert, Earl of Gloucester. Henry may have seen qualities in Matilda that made him think she'd be a more capable ruler. Despite only being 23 when she was widowed, she was politically experienced and had acted as her husband's regent in northern Italy. So Henry had a plan. His daughter, the Dowager Empress, would rule after him. She would secure his legacy and the immortality of his bloodline. At the Christmas court in Westminster in 1026, Henry made all his leading barons swear an oath to support Matilda as his heir in England and Normandy. They obediently queued up and did so. In 1131, he made them do it again, just to confirm that they meant it. After his fishy-breathed death in 1135, it turned out that they didn't. Chapter 17. King Stephen. The next reign began exactly like the previous one. An opportunistic usurper raced to get himself crowned and became king as a fait accompli. The opportunist in question was called Stephen of Blois. He was the fourth son of one of William the Conqueror's daughters, so wasn't a legitimate king by primogeniture, porphyrogeniture, or people whose names begin with hogeniture. Stephen had been knocking around Henry's court all his life and was a charming and popular figure. He was lucky as well. He had been on board the White Ship in Barfleur before it set sail, but a violent case of the shits forced him to disembark. Whatever fetid privy he settled onto once he'd hurried ashore turned out to be a far more auspicious enthronement than his subsequent one in Westminster, and made much less of a mess. The old king liked Stephen, and 5 years after the White Ship disaster, by which point he was pooing normally, Henry had arranged for him to marry the rich heiress to the County of Boulogne, who, like Henry's first queen, was a descendant of the kings of Wessex. Her name was Matilda, too, I'm afraid. Matilda may be a common name for a queen at this time, but Stephen is an unusual one for a king, and to a great extent that's thanks to this Stephen. He's so badly thought of that no one would touch that regnal name with a sterilised sceptre thereafter. For a king's name to catch on, you need one or two successful ones to get it going. There are quite a few Williams and Henrys, but only one Stephen and one John. The main reason people don't like Stephen is his rivalry with the Empress Matilda. She was clearly the person her father had wanted to succeed him. Very clearly. However, Stephen and a few others wouldn't have admitted as much and would have cited the schism that existed between Henry I and his daughter at the time of his death. It was a row about some castles in Normandy that Henry was refusing to hand over to Matilda and her second husband, Geoffrey, Count of Anjou. They'd been part of her dowry. Henry was probably concerned that Geoffrey would use them to try and take over Normandy. It was a classic case of an old man refusing to loosen his grip on power, as much in defiance of approaching death as anything else. It seems vanishingly unlikely that this spat, coming as it did in the wake of Matilda giving birth to his first two legitimate male grandchildren, an event which delighted Henry, not that he can have smiled, maybe he gave a sombre-faced thumbs up, would have led the old king to rethink his succession plans. There's little doubt that Stephen was defying his uncle and mentor's wishes when he took the throne. And no doubt that Stephen had sworn an oath twice to support Matilda as the next sovereign. This behaviour has gone down badly with posterity because Empress Matilda is a sympathetic figure. A woman in a man's world, robbed of her rights, accused by contemporaries both of lacking the traditionally male strengths to rule and of being unnatural and unfeminine whenever she displayed those strengths, but refusing to give in and let Stephen be king. All in all, she's a Crufts-winning underdog. While Stephen, a man who stole the throne and then held on to it ineffectually, is hard to like. Except, I suspect, if you met him. He's talked of as a very nice guy in person. Having myself once met and warmed to Boris Johnson, I'm aware of the limitations and fickleness of this attribute. But it's interesting. Stephen's life was defined by one opportunistic moment of colossal self-interest. But it seems likely that, had he not stolen the title of king, Stephen might have qualified for that of nice man. Meanwhile, Matilda gets called haughty. Contemporary descriptions of her personality are less reliable than those of Stephen, though. Her alleged haughtiness was probably more about the attitudes of the age. The very thing she was trying to do, be the ruler of a kingdom, was deemed by most to be unbearably haughty behaviour before she'd even opened her mouth, and the fact that she called herself Empress is unlikely to have diffused that impression. The most frustrating thing about Stephen was that, despite following Henry I's example closely in the manner of his seizing power and the promises he issued to powerful people in the realm, he then completely departed from his predecessor's strategy of kingship. He couldn't stick to being firm but predictable. He lacked ruthlessness and he displayed favouritism. He needed to be clear and unwavering in his conduct, vicious to those who opposed him and even-handedly generous to supporters. But he wasn't. And this created bad feeling, uncertainty, rebellion. It stoked the fires of guilt for those who'd sworn to support Matilda and sparked opportunism in those who reckoned they'd do better if the regime changed. All of this was succour to Matilda's cause. The conflict that this led to when Matilda finally came over to England to pursue her claim in 1139 has been referred to by historians since Victorian times as the Anarchy. It won't surprise you to hear that this term has since fallen out of favour. Apparently, it's a simplistic label. I'm sure it is, but that's pretty much the deal with names. I'd say Brian is a simplistic label for the guy who came to fix our washing machine, but it's still his name. I don't reckon we'd get to the root of the man any better by calling him Adrian. It wasn't nice, the Anarchy. It was a big and brutal civil war, and my main feeling about it throughout, and this must have been the sentiment of the overwhelming majority of people in England at the time, is a desperation for one side or the other to win. It really didn't matter which, except to two people. If Stephen had a quarter of the usurper competence of his predecessor, Matilda wouldn't have had a look in, and millions of people, men and women alike, would have had a much nicer time in the 1140s. It would have been so much better all round if he'd managed to secure the throne properly and there hadn't been a civil war. It wouldn't have been fair on Matilda, but nothing had ever been fair on Robert Curthose, and if he'd been King of England, he'd have ended up mortgaging the rivers. Justice for people who are already beneficiaries of a massively unjust system becomes difficult to give much of a damn about. The Snow Empress. Oxford Castle, I felt when visiting it in the late 1980s, gives a powerful sense of incarceration. I grew up in Oxford, and as a fan of castles, it had always seemed weird to me that this otherwise extremely historical city didn't seem to have a proper one. It had tea rooms and museums, and the country's first ever branch of Past Times. But instead of a castle, there was just a small artificial green hill with nothing on it, that you could glimpse over the top of a tall stone wall just down the road from Marks and Spencer's. "That's Oxford Castle," my parents would say. No one was allowed to go there. The reason for this inaccessibility was, ironically, continuity of use. At that point, Oxford Castle, unlike almost every other Norman fortress, had not yet been abandoned to the elements and then tourism. When it fell out of military use in the late Middle Ages and its fortifications started to fall into disrepair, it nevertheless continued as an administrative centre for what became Oxfordshire County Council and as a courthouse and jail. The site had been redeveloped piecemeal over the centuries to accommodate these continuing functions. This is what it was like by the 1980s. Next to the hill, which was a Norman motte from which the stone keep had been removed in the early 18th century, was a building that looked very castly indeed. It was covered in arrow slits and crenellations and mini turrets. It was protesting far too much and clearly wasn't actually a castle. The stonework was too even and there was parking in front. It was merely castle-themed, like a Vegas casino. It was, in fact, the County Hall, built in 1841 in the Gothic Revival style. Next to this, constructed in 1973, was New County Hall. This was built not in the Gothic Revival style, but in a style that I pray will never be revived. I no longer have the energy to think that buildings like this are anything but ugly. Willfully ugly. 50% concrete and 50% tinted glass. The sort of thing that features in the title sequence of The Office, or would be the headquarters for the secret police in a cash-poor totalitarian state. It feels like the architect either wanted it to look horrible or was worse at his job than King Stephen. It's almost penitential, the architecture of that era, a deliberate rejection of aesthetic convention, which I'm now resigned to being too bourgeois to enjoy. Speaking of the penitential, behind them all, incorporating the only bits of medieval stonework that remained above ground into a part 18th century and part Victorian structure, was HM Prison Oxford. Brimming, I imagined at the time, with the nemesis of Inspector Morse. This was why the castle mound wasn't open to the public. It directly overlooked the prison. Allowing people onto that hillock was deemed a security risk. My visit in the 1980s was a one-off, part of a scheme, I seem to remember, to open just for one day of the year places that were usually closed. I took the opportunity to help a couple of fraudsters to freedom. I remember two things about the castle. First, the amazing vaulted well chamber that was concealed inside the motte, a genuinely haunting space that is presumably genuinely haunted. And second, the view of the wing of the old prison. It looked grimmer even than the new county hall, and whoever was giving us the tour explained disapprovingly that it was massively overcrowded and was supposed to have been closed years ago. It was like an illustration by Phiz, a rebuke of the Victorian era. Except, to be fair on that era, the 1980s prison contained many more prisoners than its 19th century designers ever intended. That's Thatcher for you. As I remember it, I could see glimpses of inmates through the windows, tattooed forearms thrust through the bars. It feels unlikely, but that's what my brain tells me I remember. So, as I say, incarceration was very much the ambiance. It felt like a troubled place. In general, it's a troubled part of Oxford, the southwest of the centre, between the castle and the river, racked by relentless redevelopment. In his enormous book, London, the Biography, Peter Ackroyd writes evocatively about the Rookeries, London's early 19th century slums located around the Church of St Giles in the Fields. This church was on the route from Newgate Prison to the gallows at Tyburn, and from the 15th century onwards, the church wardens developed the rather fun tradition of standing the condemned prisoners a drink, known as St Giles's Bowl, at the Angel pub next door, on their way to being executed. These themes of crime, alcohol and death continued to dominate the area as it descended towards its Dickensian nadir. Then, in the 1840s, an attempt was made to sort this out by constructing New Oxford Street, an extension of Oxford Street eastwards through the Rookeries. Ackroyd's point is that this redevelopment never quite took. The area was too broken, its unhappiness too ingrained, to let it shake off its past and become a merry extension to the capitalistic confidence of Oxford Street or the twinkling bustle of Covent Garden. He's right about the neighbourhood. New Oxford Street, dominated by the enormous Centrepoint building, is windswept and bleak. Yet the idea that its history, almost its aura, is what prevents it from shaking off a grim ambiance is fanciful, but also attractive. The Oxbens area of Oxford, as the section between the castle and the Thames is known, reminds me of Ackroyd's idea. It feels like scar tissue. This was the monastic area of Oxford, home to Owsney Abbey, Rewley Abbey and St Fridwives Priory, rich and prestigious institutions that were destroyed in the 16th century dissolution of the monasteries. They had been founded at the time when the first students were beginning to form a university. The university had grown up alongside them, and their sudden eclipse changed the centre of gravity of the city. Oxpens, which was outside the city walls, became the city's seamier quarter. This was where there were slums, pubs, brothels, and in the 19th century, industry. A brewery, a factory and a gasworks, all on the same side of town as the council offices and prison. None of it very Oxford. This was the part of town chosen for the railway station. In the mid to late 20th century, when industry was declining but expectations of housing standards were on the rise, the planners raised much of the area and moved the residents out to new housing estates on the edge of town. And the area was redeveloped again, a shopping centre, multi-storey car park, further education college and ice rink all appeared with a new road, the Oxpens Road, bleaker even than New Oxford Street, built through the wasteland. That's how it was throughout my childhood. They've redeveloped it again since, when the prison finally closed in 1996 and became a Malmaison hotel. That castle precinct, given up to tourism with no intervening centuries of picturesque decay, teems with chain restaurants. The shopping centre and car park have been demolished and replaced with a different shopping centre and car park. Plus, there's still a large area of waste ground. Maybe someone will start a Benedictine monastery there now that's allowed again. This feels like the least historical part of Oxford. Apart from a hill, a tower and a few foundations, there's nothing old here. The rest of the city centre is crammed with ancient buildings that seem untouched, the colleges of the university, the stone quadrangles of which have been cleaned and repointed, had Virginia creeper and wisteria grown up them, and latterly electricity and Wi-Fi installed, but otherwise have been left in peace. The Oxpens area hasn't seen much peace. History keeps happening to it. It's not picturesque. But to stand in it and see what it is now, while knowing all the things it has been, brings you closer to understanding history than the quiet of an untouched cloister. I'm talking about this area because from my school days onwards, I was taught that here, before the traffic and the sculpted verges and the FE college and the ice rink, before the pubs and slums and factories and brothels, back when the monasteries were new, an empress escaped from the castle through the snow and fled across the frozen river, wrapped in a white cloak. The castle had become a prison for her, just as it would be for thousands after her. But her jailers were outside the walls. King Stephen and his army had placed it under siege. "I'm an empress, get me out of here." With Oxford in Stephen's hands and his army settling down for a long siege, Matilda had realised her best bet was to run for it. In the middle of December 1142, she used the cover of night and snow, and the fact that the river was frozen, to slip out of one of the castle gates, or according to some of the more helmet-horn-inclined chroniclers, be lowered down the castle walls, accompanied by a handful of white-clad knights, and steal through Stephen's unsuspecting army, across the ice of the river to the friendly fortress of Wallingford. It was daring, dramatic, and slightly magical. But the fact that Matilda's choice was between staying in a castle and escaping from a castle is illustrative of a big problem England faced during the anarchy. Castles. They'd only been around for 75 years, but they were making the country ungovernable. What had been devised as an instrument for asserting Norman control over a foreign land was, under new circumstances where the Normans weren't all on the same side anymore, becoming a catalyst of chaos. The trouble was, it was very difficult to get people out of them. Not impossible, but an enormous hassle. Assaulting or laying siege to a castle took a large amount of time and resources, and you could only do that so many times before you lost the will to live, or, it being the Middle Ages, stopped living. If you had errant barons holed up in dozens of castles all over the countryside, you were screwed. Castles are like the 12th century's asbestos. Seemed like such a great idea, got put in everywhere, and then the lethal and resource-hungry consequences dragged on for decades. Because of the complete collapse of central governmental control, this asbestos kept being installed even as its damaging effects became clear. In fact, it was introduced at an accelerating pace because the advantages of it were enjoyed by the castle builders, while the metaphorical toxicity, the thing that poisoned England's governability, affected only the already enfeebled state. Like an impregnable castle wall, my asbestos simile survived the paragraph. More castles kept being built. Henry, Bishop of Winchester, a major power broker at the time, and King Stephen's younger brother, built six himself. With help, obviously, he got guys in. And some castles never fell. Wallingford, for example, where Matilda fled to, was a thorn in King Stephen's side throughout the war. It was far to the east of Matilda's area of influence, which centred around Bristol and Gloucester, and uncomfortably close to Stephen's heartland in London and the east, and Stephen could not get into it. He built two castles of his own nearby in an attempt to neutralise the impact of its presence. You can see that things have gone a bit crazy when it's easier to build two new castles than gain access to one. When Matilda reached the haven of Wallingford in December 1142, she'd been in England for 3.5 years. At one point, she'd nearly become queen. She had arrived in 1139, accompanied by her half-brother, Robert, Earl of Gloucester. He had been a trusted advisor to his father, Henry I, and was a capable general who had never been keen on the Stephen regime and couldn't quite put the oath he'd sworn to support Matilda from his mind, so had rebelled against the king the year before. On arrival, Robert headed straight to his power base of Bristol, while Matilda stayed at Arundel Castle as a guest of the Dowager Queen Adeliza, who was now married to the Earl of Arundel. Stephen swiftly arrived with an army, but on the advice of his younger brother, Henry, that castle-building Bishop of Winchester, he decided to let Matilda go. This seems bonkers, but there are other ways of looking at it. It wouldn't have looked great, laying siege to the castle and, if successful, which was by no means guaranteed, imprisoning his cousin. It wouldn't have seemed very chivalrous. Plus, by escorting her to Bristol, Stephen had his two main enemies, Matilda and Robert, in the same place, so he wasn't fighting on two fronts. I still think it was bonkers, though. In a game, when you don't know what to do, a good rule of thumb is to do whatever your opponent wants least. In this case, I'm pretty sure Matilda didn't want to be under siege and did want to be escorted safely to Bristol. I reckon this is a case of Stephen suffering an ill-timed and self-defeating bout of decency. If he wanted to be chivalrous to Matilda, he shouldn't have stolen the throne from her. It was an eccentric moment to suddenly give a shit about her feelings. Matilda may have been pleased, but she was well short of grateful. Stephen must have subsequently concluded it was a mistake, because a few years down the line, when he had her trapped in Oxford Castle, no offer of safe escort was forthcoming. Fighting the bad fight. Once Matilda and Robert were settled in the West Country, Stephen's problems started mounting. Lords were defecting to her cause in dribs and drabs, encouraged by both her presence in England and the progress her husband, Geoffrey of Anjou, was making conquering Normandy. The situation in Normandy had a constant and unpredictable impact on the one in England, because the nobility was still motivated by that desire for the same person to be in charge in both places. This was much more important to them than who that person happened to be. This had been demonstrated every time Robert Curthose was in the frame for either job. Ultimately, it was the clear fact that Curthose would never oust either William II or Henry I from the English throne that made the barons happy to get rid of him as Duke of Normandy. Another clear illustration of the Norman barons' priorities came soon after Henry I's death, when Stephen's elder brother, Theobald, Count of Blois, was briefly acclaimed as Duke. He was a viable candidate, and the powerful men of the duchy settled on him. Just as in England, the oaths to support Matilda were put from their minds. Then the news of Stephen's coronation arrived, and Theobald was hastily unacclaimed, and Stephen acclaimed instead of him. Unlike Matilda, Theobald went along with this. But it's a reminder. Most of the barons don't support Stephen or Matilda, they just want one of them to win big in both places, because that's what will bring them peace and prosperity. This means that, as well as attending to their own personal interests and supporting whichever faction is most likely to reward them or least likely to punish them, they're constantly on the lookout for momentum, for the right bandwagon to jump on. But as we've seen, the momentum in this civil war came crashing against the near-immovable object of a dozen castle walls. An important and illustrative figure in all this was Ranulf de Gernon, Earl of Chester. He and his father before him had enjoyed an almost semi-regal status and controlled a large area of the north. Unfortunately, it became a much smaller area of the north when King David I of Scotland invaded in support of Matilda at the start of Stephen's reign. Stephen decided to appease David by granting him much of northern England. While the Scottish king, a protégé of Henry I, was pro-Matilda, the huge enlargement of his kingdom was a higher priority, so this saw off the Scottish threat for the time being. Ranulf, on the other hand, was pissed off and looking for an opportunity to regain his former position. He defected to Matilda. This was what led to the Battle of Lincoln on the 2nd of February 1141, the closest the war came to a decisive clash. An army led by Robert of Gloucester and Ranulf of Chester faced King Stephen's army outside the city of Lincoln, defeated it, and captured the king. At this point, Matilda nearly achieved the seemingly impossible and got crowned queen. Queen regnant, not just queen consort, so the actual boss. She was declared by an assembly of clergy and nobles in Winchester in April to be Lady of England and Normandy, as a precursor to a coronation. This declaration was organised by the city's bishop, Henry of Blois, the king's younger brother who had given him that dodgy advice at Arundel. He's a slippery figure who evokes Michael Gove in my mind. He was quite sanguine about his elder brother's imprisonment and content to work with the new regime. He even handed the royal treasury, still kept at Winchester, to Matilda. Sadly, there was hardly anything in it. The situation looked good for Matilda, but things didn't work out. Stephen may have been imprisoned in Bristol Castle, but his queen, the other main Matilda on the scene, was working hard on his behalf. She, together with Stephen's most prominent military commander, William of Ypres, raised an army in the southeast. Meanwhile, Empress Matilda, who went to Westminster to prepare to be crowned, was rejected by the citizenry of London, who were pro-Stephen. They rose up and she was forced to flee to Oxford in the middle of dinner. Henry of Blois pointedly fled somewhere different, Winchester, and changed sides again. There would be no coronation. A disastrous attempt by Matilda to take Henry's castle in Winchester followed and ended in defeat and the capture of Robert of Gloucester. So vital was he to Matilda's cause that she released King Stephen to get him back. Stephen and Queen, as opposed to Empress, Matilda, were back in business and the pre-Battle of Lincoln stalemate restored. The two of them had themselves re-crowned at Christmas 1141, and the following year Stephen marched north and persuaded Ranulf de Gernon to change sides again. This was the situation when Matilda found herself surrounded at Oxford Castle, and her daring escape and re-establishment of her rival court at Devizes Castle just reaffirmed the stalemate. Stephen was very much still king, even if he didn't control the whole country, and the only good news for Matilda was her husband's gradual conquest of Normandy, which Stephen had no time or money to prevent. This culminated in Geoffrey being proclaimed duke in 1144. In 1147, Robert of Gloucester died, and the following year, Matilda went back to Normandy, never to return. It was a grim and futile period. It's tempting to pick a side, and then it's tricky not to pick Matilda, who was wronged by Stephen and overall a more effective political operator, coping manfully with the disadvantages of being a woman in the 12th century. But my feeling is that we shouldn't be distracted from the bigger truth that they were both twats. They may not have been able to help being twats. The mores and values of the time and of their class may have made them twats, but they were twats, and terrible things happened as a result. Having kings is an awful system. Henry I, for all his brutality, draws the eye away from this truth because he was capable and professional. In modern parlance, he gave a good service to the community. When Stephen seized the throne in exactly the same way as Henry did, one is tempted to see a basic intradynastic meritocracy developing. Then it turns out that the opportunistic cheek-slash-gumption-slash-amorality needed to steal a crown doesn't correlate with the skills required to use its powers wisely. Stephen was a twat. And Matilda was a twat. She was more competent than Stephen as a ruler, but she knew, once he'd taken the throne, how slender her chances of ruling instead of him were. She still went for it, and if it didn't always cause anarchy, it definitely caused the anarchy. I can't see her decision to fight him as striking a blow for women's rights. The notion is much more of an anachronism than being a twat, which is an eternal problem. Stephen and Matilda were just colossally entitled posh people whose incompatible ambitions caused enormous suffering. The poor barons often get a bad press for changing sides in the conflict as they desperately try to protect their own interests. Failing to find a sincere preference and then stick to it through thick and thin apparently makes them morally suspect. Protecting their own position isn't deemed a sufficiently ethical justification for action. Except it is for the twats. Oh yes, they're important throne claimants. Their interests and desires and rights are elevated to a point of principle. Everyone else has a duty to pick one side or another, like in a debate on Twitter. Resist it. They were both as bad as each other. The fact that they didn't know it should only be added to their failings. I can't forgive either of them for thinking that the question of which one of them ruled England was so colossally important that it was okay for everyone else in the country to have such a horrible time. Chapter 18. King Henry II. In 1149, Geoffrey, Count of Anjou and Duke of Normandy, did an unusual thing. He gave up his dukedom in favour of his son. The son was called Henry, and he was also Empress Matilda's son and Henry I's grandson. Henry was 16 years old and Geoffrey in his late 30s. This was selfless, self-controlled, and very rare. Normandy was Geoffrey's greatest possession, and putting it in the hands of his son was taking a risk with his own future. The levels of trust within royal families at this time were not high. Stephen and Matilda were first cousins. Fathers were often betrayed by ambitious sons. In time, Geoffrey's own son would be betrayed by his ambitious grandsons. Geoffrey's father-in-law, Henry I, for all his exhaustive succession planning, remained, even when he started to feel the end of his life approaching, bitterly opposed to ceding any power at all pre-mortem. Geoffrey's decision is unusual. In dynastic terms, it was an excellent piece of estate planning. Geoffrey was nicknamed Plantagenet because he had the habit of wearing a yellow sprig of broom blossom, or Plantagenista, in his hat. And that name has been given by historians to the English royal house that descended from him. The Plantagenets officially reigned from the accession of Geoffrey's son to the death of Richard III. They are England's longest reigning dynasty, it is proclaimed, lasting far longer than the Normans, Tudors, or Stuarts. In the English Royal House's championship, they are way ahead on points. This seems a bit of an arbitrary accolade, as the name wasn't used by anyone between Geoffrey himself and Richard, 3rd Duke of York, who lived in the 15th century. By that ducal Richard's time, the royal family had acrimoniously split into Yorkist and Lancastrian branches, and Richard resurrected the name to emphasise that he was directly descended from a line of kings. So I don't see that it really means anything to say that the kings after Stephen and before Henry VII are all Plantagenets, and the ones on either side aren't, when they're all related to each other. Most Plantagenet rulers didn't identify as Plantagenets at the time, only as legitimate kings. This is not to say that the accession of Henry Plantagenet, as he wasn't then known, or Henry Fitz-Empress, as he was, didn't feel new. It did. It had a tremendous aura of novelty. There was an enormous sense of optimism, strength, and unity about the accession of the young king. But how did he get to that point? He wasn't King Stephen's son, and when Henry became Duke of Normandy, Stephen had two legitimate sons still alive. It was Geoffrey and Matilda's decision to make their son Duke of Normandy that put him in the position to win the crown. The nobility in England and Normandy continued to want what they'd wanted since the conquest, one strong king of both places. Stephen was not a strong king, had patchy control of England and patchier control of Normandy. Matilda was a woman, had less control of England than Stephen, and Geoffrey, the man who came to control Normandy on her behalf, wasn't trusted. He was from the ruling house of Anjou, the Angevins, and the Normans considered them dodgy. It was said they were descended from a demon countess, a literal fiend of hell who was frightened of going into churches, though was presumably dead sexy. It was also said, more plausibly, that they were powerful and ambitious neighbours and competitors. The situation was finely balanced, hence civil war. Once he was made Duke, young Henry's prospects started to tip the balance in favour of Matilda's party. His reputedly demonic Angevin blood notwithstanding, he was a young and plausible-seeming fellow, in complete control of Normandy, with a major power base in England, thanks to his mother, and indisputably Henry I's male heir. He looked like a better bet than the ageing and ineffectual Stephen, or his eldest son, Eustace, Count of Boulogne. The position only strengthened in the early 1150s. First, Geoffrey suddenly died in 1151, so that Henry became Count of Anjou, Touraine and Maine as well. Then, in 1152, he made a stellar marriage to a rich heiress who had just split up with King Louis VII of France. To complete her exotic allure, she wasn't even called Matilda. Eleanor of Aquitaine had her marriage to the King of France annulled in March, and, narrowly evading those who sought to kidnap and marry her, she sent a message to Henry, Duke of Normandy, to come and marry her himself, which, on the 18th of May, he did. Dynastic marriages are in general a boring subject. The endless betrothing of 8-year-olds to 12-year-olds, of English princesses to German princes, Spanish princes to Burgundian countesses, etc., all in a bid to create or cement alliances. Half the marriages never seem to happen, and less than half of the alliances ever stick. In an environment where brothers fight wars against each other, where sons try and overthrow fathers, I've never quite understood why there was any expectation that you could rely on your in-laws. But this one's different. This was very cool. Eleanor was the most eligible woman in Europe, had just sloughed off the King of France, and now Henry was her chosen consort. No one's fathers were organising this. This was the conscious decision of two intelligent and powerful adults. It was an act of confidence and irreverence on both their parts. It showed contempt for Louis VII, so recently Eleanor's lord and master, and nominally Henry's feudal overlord. Only nominally, though. Through Eleanor, Henry now ruled the vast duchy of Aquitaine, on top of his other possessions. He controlled a larger area of France than its king, and a larger area in general than the King of England. In the face of this power couple, the ageing Stephen cut a feeble figure. When Henry arrived in England with a small army in 1153, all the momentum was with him. In July, Henry and Stephen's armies met outside Wallingford Castle, rather appropriately. But the nobles on both sides refused to fight. They'd had enough. The enraged king and duke were forced to talk. They did a deal. Stephen would stay king, but Henry would be adopted as his heir. There you go, guys. Was that really so hard? The main obstacle to this working was Eustace, Stephen's son, but he was so furious that the deal was even being considered that in August he conveniently died, apparently in a fit of madness. Stephen's formidable wife Matilda had died a couple of weeks before Henry married Eleanor, so the king was now comprehensively outwifed and an increasingly lonely figure. He spent what remained of his reign a bit like a constitutional monarch, parading around in royal regalia. He died in October 1154, and Henry's succession was so assured he didn't even bother to come to England to get crowned until late December. It's all a bit stressful. As a child, I had a poor sense of drama. It didn't feel to me that stories particularly required events. I was comforted not by fictional narratives, but by fictional contexts. Narnia, the TARDIS, the cave where the children make a base and eat tinned fruit in the Valley of Adventure. I would happily have watched an episode of Star Trek that depicted the USS Enterprise on an unremarkable day. I just wanted to see the ship driving from planet to planet, the crew going about their business, a bit of beaming up and down. Perhaps something getting phased at some point, but it could just be target practice on an uninhabited moon. The spaceship was amazing enough. Why the need for all that jeopardy and things getting damaged? So when I was first taught about Henry II and the Angevin Empire, as his vast dominions of England, most of France and nominally Ireland are sometimes called, I was most comforted by the thought of this huge realm just being. And that's how it was taught to me. Henry ruled all those realms with energy and intelligence. He was constantly on the move with his court, hurrying from one area to the next. He made important and intelligent judicial reforms, and he didn't suffer fools gladly. That's what I wanted to hear. That sounded cool and mighty, but also calm and organised, like the USS Enterprise. Unfortunately, as the constantly on the move bit implies, it may have been organised, but it wasn't calm. Henry's empire was like lots of plates spinning on poles all over Western Europe. He had to keep going round them to keep them going round. This was a preferable situation to Stephen's reign, which in the same analogy was the constant sound of breaking china, then the groan of Stephen bending down, then the smell of inexpertly applied glue. But it was dependent on energy and motion, on ambition and war. One of the ways Henry kept his huge realm together was by trying to extend it. There was none of the stasis of him just being in charge, like Captain Kirk or Aslan. There was a literal and metaphorical direction of travel. Something was always fucking happening. But what really spoils the ordered vision of successful kingship that I crave is that his reign was dominated by his falling out with people. His falling out with his wife and children, and his falling out with his best friend. And the church. Like most medieval kings, he fell out with the church. But Henry's way of doing it was really awkward and unfortunate. I'm talking about Thomas Becket, Henry's hotshot administrator. You may well have heard him called Thomas à Becket, but the à is a random 16th century addition, possibly motivated by a Protestant desire to make a major Catholic sound daft. It stuck, probably because it doesn't sound daft, but actually works very well rhythmically. The king had plucked him from obscurity and made him chancellor. When I say obscurity, I don't mean to suggest Becket was a peasant. He was, in the overall scheme of things, quite high up the social ladder, as is made obvious by two facts about him. First, he was literate. His ability to read and write was crucial to his being in a sufficiently unobscure bit of obscurity for Henry to be able to see clearly enough to pluck him. When he was plucked, he was already Archdeacon of Canterbury, having been previously plucked from a more obscure obscurity by Theobald of Bec, the Archbishop of Canterbury. The second sign that he'd have looked pretty posh to a slave, serf, peasant, or general tradesman was that he was from a Norman family. The things he could read and write were French and Latin, not Old English, which, as we know, people had basically stopped reading and writing 100 years earlier after all the Anglo-Saxon posh people were killed or dispossessed. His family had come over with the Normans and settled in London, where Becket was born in around 1120 on Cheapside. He was middle class at a time when there hardly was a middle class, and if there was one, it would only have existed in London. So he was the metropolitan elite. Still, Becket may well have been the least posh person a king at this time would ever actually speak to, so he'd done well for himself. And he behaved like he had, decking himself in the finery of his office. In 1157, he went to Paris to negotiate the betrothal of Henry's 2-year-old son Henry to King Louis VII of France's 1-year-old daughter Margaret. This diplomatic marriage led to a lasting peace between the governments in London and Paris, which began only 747 years later. The futility of the tedious dynastic marriage aside, Becket travelled in what sounds like ridiculous splendour. He took 24 outfits, had 12 pack horses to carry his silver dinner service, 8 wagons of baggage, and horses with monkeys riding them. That last is particularly flamboyant and was surely Becket's idea. "If I don't have horses with monkeys riding them, the King of France won't take me seriously." He sounds like the 12th century equivalent of a rap star. King Henry, in contrast, liked to keep things simple and rarely displayed his riches. That's social confidence for you. He was as posh as they come, son of an empress and a count and grandson of a king. Meanwhile, Becket had the classic Nouve's instinct to show off, to demonstrate to the world how far he'd come. He would definitely have got a personalised number plate. It seems Henry used to take the piss. There's a story about the two of them riding through London when they saw an old man in a ragged coat. I don't know what everyone else in London was doing, but that's the scene. The king and his chancellor on horses and an old man in a shit coat who gets talked about. "It would be an act of charity to give that man a cloak," said Henry in naturalistic Norman French. "Yes," replied Thomas. "As king, you should do something about that." Henry then tried to take Thomas's very expensive and fine cloak off him and give it to the man. There was a bit of a tussle, but Henry won, surprise, surprise, and the old man got a weird, blingy garment that was totally inappropriate for his lifestyle. It's a grim anecdote. The tussle is the mortifying bit. I can't help imagining a red-faced Thomas with his hair all ruffled, trying to laugh it off as he shivered on his horse afterwards. Kings can be tricky. But it seems the two men were sincere friends, or Henry thought they were. For all Henry's military skill, administrative energy, and overall intelligence, he showed poor judgment of character when it came to Becket. He thought their friendship and Becket's personal loyalty to him was so solid that it would be a good idea to make Becket Archbishop of Canterbury. Render unto Caesar. I'm afraid it's time for a few paragraphs on the church. Right. Medieval kings really like being in charge of things. Not just lots of things, but everything. All the things in their kingdom. The poor kings of France were miserable for hundreds of years because there were times, like the one we're talking about now, when there were hardly any bits of their kingdom that they were in charge of. England is different, and English kings really do aspire to run the place in quite a control-freaky way. It sounds obvious, but I actually find it strange. Personally, I don't want to be in charge of much. It's an admin hassle, and it makes things your fault. I'd much rather carp from the sidelines. Political leaders today, in Britain at least, are increasingly of my way of thinking. Many politicians seem to want to hold high office, but for most of the things that actually happen, which inevitably go a bit wrong and piss people off, to be someone else's responsibility. David Cameron was great at this. His government did lots of things that people didn't like. Austerity, NHS reform, hiked tuition fees, a new national curriculum, police cuts. But they were all portrayed by the Prime Minister as someone else's policy. George Osborne, Andrew Lansley, the Lib Dems, Michael Gove and Theresa May were the people actually doing this regrettable stuff. Cameron just stood outside Downing Street looking plausible. At one point, when he was still Prime Minister, he even wrote to Tory-controlled Oxfordshire County Council complaining about cuts, as if they had nothing to do with him. Over the really big issues, where it might otherwise have been tricky for the Prime Minister to show zero political leadership, he got around it by holding referendums. Say what you like about the man, but he wasn't power-crazed. He took a very different attitude to your standard medieval king. He would have been happy for many policy areas to have been in the remit of, and therefore the fault of, the church and the Pope. This was not Henry II's view, or the view of any rulers at this time. In the late 11th and early 12th centuries, there'd been a huge row, and by row I mean war, between the Holy Roman Emperor and the Pope, over which one of them got to appoint bishops and abbots, and indeed future popes. Over the preceding centuries, this had tended to be done by local powers, despite the fact that the church nominally had jurisdiction. The authorities in Rome had decided this wasn't on.
Broadly, and perhaps surprisingly, the church succeeded in shifting the position in its favour, and the centuries of bishops and abbots being picked by local rulers and the Pope by the Holy Roman Emperor came to an end. For the kings, this situation rankled. They felt a keen sense of ownership of their kingdoms, and for the Pope to be deciding things within them was deeply intrusive. It was an awkward state of affairs because they were very religious people. They acknowledged that the Pope mattered, and his power to excommunicate them, to cut them off from the Church's route to salvation, was formidable to them. But they felt that, as anointed kings, they possessed their own measure of ineffable ecclesiastical power. They were holy too. Under these circumstances, there are obvious advantages to a king having the senior prelate in the land, the Archbishop of Canterbury, in his pocket. Or, you know, pouch, tied up in a bit of cloth, stuffed in a scabbard. Theobald of Bec, the archbishop who crowned Henry and had been in office for much of the Stephen and Matilda shitstorm, was a fairly pro-Angevin primate. He had done Henry a favour by refusing to crown Stephen's son Eustace while Stephen was still alive. This habit of getting the next king anointed, ready for the current one to die, was a continental technique for avoiding succession crises, but it hadn't caught on in England, though, as you may remember, King Offa of Mercia had done it centuries earlier. Stephen's motivation for wanting to give it a go was obvious. The main thing that had scuppered Matilda's chances was the fact that Stephen had got himself crowned so quickly. The presence of a pre-crowned heir from the House of Blois could have scotched her son's chances in the same way. But Theobald wasn't having it, so that was fine. In 1161, Theobald died, and Henry was worried that a less amenable cleric would be appointed in his place. Then he thought, wouldn't it be great if my best mate Becket, who does absolutely everything I tell him to, really efficiently as well, and I actually like spending time with, which I couldn't say about Theobald, if I'm honest, nice old duffer though he was, became Archbishop of Canterbury. Wouldn't that be amazing? He could be Archbishop and Chancellor at the same time, and then I'll be in charge of everything, which is as it should be. So Henry threw everything at Becket getting the job, apparently failing to notice that Thomas himself didn't seem that enthusiastic. And as he did in most of his aims in his career, he succeeded. In May 1162, the appointment was confirmed, even though Becket wasn't even an ordained priest. So, on the 2nd of June, he was ordained a priest, and on the 3rd, he was consecrated as Archbishop of Canterbury. A meteoric ecclesiastical rise that continued apace because, spoiler alert, 10 years later he was canonised a saint. By now he must be an archangel at least, that's if he isn't the current god. Henry was pleased. Then he was disappointed when Becket immediately resigned as Chancellor. He was going to be a very different archbishop to how the king had imagined. This was a monumental cock-up for Henry. As soon as Becket was installed at the head of the church hierarchy, he went native and became an intransigent defender and maximiser of the church's rights in the face of the crown. To Henry, it seemed like he'd completely changed personality. Maybe he had, or maybe he was revealing his true self. Workplace bullying. Henry and Becket, as king and archbishop, had an abysmal working relationship, and it made the king very angry. The thing that made the Becket situation particularly infuriating was that it was Henry's own fault. Becket hadn't promised to be an easygoing, biddable archbishop. Henry had just assumed he would be. Every disobliging action of Becket's was something that on some level Henry had done to himself through his own colossal misjudgment. He had a bad temper to begin with. There's one story of Henry getting so angry about someone saying something nice about the King of Scotland, with whom he was at that point displeased, that he tore his own clothes off and ended up sitting on the floor chewing straw. Historians sometimes refer to this as the Plantagenet temper. Apparently Geoffrey had a temper too, and later kings are also said to have inherited the Plantagenet temper. My feeling is that there's a slight nature-nurture confusion going on here. Henry I had a temper, and he wasn't a Plantagenet, and Eustace of Blois reputedly got so cross he died. My feeling is that all these kings and princes who fly off the handle when they don't get exactly what they want are the product more of circumstances than of genetics. They've been spoiled by lives in which no one ever shows disapproval of their behaviour. So I don't buy the Plantagenet temper as hereditary affliction argument, as if it's a bit like an allergy. What was hereditary was the state of affairs in which they had all spent insufficient time mastering the art of getting over themselves.
The key issue of difference between Henry and Becket was over whether royal courts had jurisdiction over clergy who were accused of secular crimes, the so-called criminis clerks. The archbishop was adamant that secular courts had no business trying priests. Henry felt the opposite. For him, the judicial system, his attempt to impose law and order on his realm, was a major part of what kingship entailed. He recoiled at the thought of the clergy letting each other off the hook for all the shitty, criminous things they were getting up to. You know what I'm talking about. Henry's view was encapsulated in a set of legislation called the Constitutions of Clarendon, which curbed church power, and in 1164 he persuaded all the bishops, including finally Becket, to agree to them. Then Becket changed his mind and fled to France, where King Louis VII was delighted to help him continue to foment trouble. But it was when Becket returned from exile in early December 1170 that things really got nasty. In Becket's absence, Henry had prevailed upon the Archbishop of York to crown his eldest son, Henry, just as Stephen had wanted for Eustace. The Pope had okayed this, but Becket was furious, and on his return excommunicated the Archbishop of York, together with the bishops of London and Salisbury, who were also at the ceremony, for infringing his right to do all of England's crowning. Coming hard on the heels of a long and tortuous period of negotiation and grudging rapprochement between Becket and Henry, this was a kick in the teeth. The excommunications called the coronation's legitimacy into doubt and jeopardised the king's succession planning. So, in a furious meeting at court, Henry said something angry. The wording is unclear, and it would have been in Norman French, so it certainly wasn't the famous phrase, "Who will rid me of this turbulent priest?" It was something more along the lines of, "What sort of a bunch of saps have I surrounded myself with that they let me get treated like shit by this fucking oik?" Four enterprising knights took it as their cue to go to England. Henry had been at Argenton in Normandy on the occasion of this particular flying off the handle. It was the site of a huge tank battle in 1944, and then, in 1988, I went there on a French exchange, so now you're up to speed. On the 29th of December 1170, they savagely murdered Becket in front of the altar of Canterbury Cathedral. They weren't snowflakes, people in the 12th century. It was a brutal and messy time, but this action was as abominable to them as it would be to us. More so, possibly. They minded murder less back then, but thought being a priest was a bigger deal, so maybe it balanced out. I'd say, as a rule of thumb, if you imagine how we'd feel if four men murdered the current Archbishop of Canterbury in front of the altar, apparently by order of the Prime Minister, that's basically how people felt back then. I reckon even Boris Johnson might have resigned. Henry II didn't resign, of course, but he was under no illusions about how terrible the act that had been done in his name was. It seems very unlikely that it was something he sincerely wanted to happen, and his repentance of the words that had caused it seems genuine. He was also, as an astute politician, aware of how dreadful it looked and how much it weakened his rule. It's good night from him. The coronation of Henry's son, known thereafter as Henry the Young King, turned out to be a mistake. Not only did it indirectly lead to Becket's murder and the grief and humbling of Henry that came from that, it also precipitated a nasty family row. The two Henrys, it transpired, had quite different views of what the younger one's coronation meant. For the father, it was just succession planning. Everyone knows who'll be king after I die, so there won't be any nastiness. But Henry the Young King reckoned it meant he was a king already. He had a point. He'd been crowned. That was the deal back then. That's all Harold had over Edgar Atheling, or Henry I over Robert.